someone will play like a descending line, and the first note of the next person's four bars would be the last note of the previous person's four bars. So it's like, I'm going to extend this idea. If you go up, I'll go down. If you play loud, I'll play loud. Or maybe you play loud and I'll play soft. But it's clear that we're listening to each other.
You're listening to the USSC Briefing Room, a podcast from the United States Study Center at the University of Sydney, where we give you a seat at the table for a USSC briefing on the latest developments in US news and foreign policy. We'll cover what you need to know and what's beneath the surface of the news.
Hello, I'm Mari Kirk, Director of Engagement and Impact here at the United States Study Center. And thank you for joining us on the USSC Briefing Room today. And just before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we're recording on today. The University of Sydney is located on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and future. Today on the podcast, we're doing something special in honor of International Jazz Day. We are looking at what jazz can teach us about democracy. It is a niche topic, but we're fortunate to be joined by the founder of the Jazz and Democracy Project, Dr. Wesley Watkins. His program integrates jazz into the study of U.S. history, government, civics, and culture, specifically, but also into the humanities more broadly, making J&D a captivating way for students to engage democratic and egalitarian ideals through a range of themes and subject areas. It has been widely popular both across the US and around the world. You may have heard Wes interviewed on ABC Radio or, for our US listeners, mentioned on NPR. So what can jazz help us understand about democracy that other musical examples cannot? How do current politics relate to this metaphor? And what traits of a good jazz musician should we also look for in a president? We're going to dive into all of this and more. So Wes, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And in addition to our standard by the numbers stat that we'll have at the end, Wes has also picked out a couple of song clips for us to listen to as we discuss different points. We'll include credits in our show notes if you want to make sure to listen to the full song for that as well.
Great.
So just to start off, this topic really spoke to me when I first heard about the project that you run. And it reminded me that when I was in year 10, I actually wrote a speech for a competition at school, which I likened American democracy to a symphony where all the parts are playing a role and they're working together in harmony. But when I heard your analogy, I realized that America isn't a symphony at all. It's way too unpredictable and open-ended. And would you say that is what makes democracy different from other forms of government? What makes jazz different from other forms of music?
Great question, first of all. So the first thing I want to say is, I think maybe it's a bias of us in the West that when we think of improvised music, we think of jazz. Or maybe it's just Americans. Maybe it's not the whole West. Maybe it's just Americans because jazz is America's classical music, as some people call it. So, but I just want to point out that jazz is not the only improvised music in the world. In fact, I think I've heard it said that most music in the world is improvised.
Okay.
Just whole traditions in Africa, India, if you think of the tabla music, for example, South America. So we tend to think of European classical music and American classical music or jazz as these two dipoles. And that's fine. I just want to point out, it's not like jazz is the only improvised music in the world. That said, I think the thing that you landed on when you found out as you grew older that America is not a symphony and everything isn't always right in the place that you think it should be, that the unpredictability is, for me at least, the allure of it. Oh. So when I'm going to a jazz show, the thing I'm looking forward to is a musical conversation. You know, it's that, okay, we know maybe the topic of conversation, which is to say, if this band is touring their latest album, maybe you've heard it and you're going to go hear how they do it live. Or you know that this one artist tends to always play this one song in every set and you want to hear that person play that song tonight. So that's the topic, but we don't know what's going to be said on that topic. And that's because of the improvised nature of jazz. So improvisation simply means make it up as you go along, create at the spur of the moment. And we expect jazz musicians to let the day be a guide along with the composition itself, the intention of the composer. But what I say on a tune tonight is largely a function of my day. And I mean that down to the specifics of touring. Like, was there a long bus ride before we got to this venue? Am I jet lagged? Are we on a, you know, a European festival tour over the summer and I'm just tired? Oh. That can come into play. I remember being in New York City and caught a set the night that the George Zimmerman verdict came down. And I later corresponded with the alto player on that set. I cannot think of his name. But we corresponded after the fact and he said, man, like, you know, I didn't know what to play. You know, so we expect your personal individual voice and the choices you make based on who you are and how you're feeling right now to come into the music. That's allowed. We want that in jazz. So in that way, you could say that the audience is involved or witnessing the unfolding of this musical conversation that the band is having, perhaps in a way like we the people are engaged in and watching the nature of our democracy unfold as our representatives in government behave in government or not. Right. A few other things on this point though. I often think back to a TED talk by Kabir Sagal. He wrote a book called Jazzocracy, which was obviously instrumental for me. And he did a TED talk in Atlanta, I think it was. And he said, we play the blues to get rid of the blues. And similarly, we use democracy to improve democracy. So that's a connection between the two. So when I say we play the blues to get rid of the blues, I'm referring to first the blues form, a type of song. 1, 4, or 5 chords often, you know, there's a bunch of different stylistic things about the blues. But we use that musical style to help ourselves process the blues feeling, the melancholy. Right. In the African-American musical tradition, you know, music was very much a life-saving force. It's a way that we connected to our essential humanity in the midst of a system that saw us as chattel. Right. And so the music is a way that we process life. Right. And so in order to make your life better, you play this music. Right. I think it's safe to say, I mean, I don't know, I'm not an expert in all the types of government around the world, but I'm not sure how much you can improve oligarchy with more oligarchy, unless you yourself suddenly rise to the level of an oligarch. But I think the democratic process invites us to engage it in order to improve it in whatever way we deem necessary. So we have that voice and the choices to engage it in that way. Lastly, there's this idea of freedom within structure in both. So I think of jazz and the democratic process both as processes. So jazz, I don't think of it so much as a genre as I do a way of making music. It's a way that we engage each other in the on the bandstand. So yes, we have that individual freedom to express ourselves, certainly as soloists, when we get to make up melodies on top of the song form that is being repeated and, you know, held down by the rhythm section. And also, even if, when you're in that position as the rhythm section, you know, you can say little things here and there while someone else is soloing, right? So, but we have, so we have that freedom, but that structure is also equally important. So what is the structure? It's the composition itself. It's the song form that results from that composition, the chord changes, the tempo, the key, all these musical things that let us know where we are musically. And then also we have a tradition. We have a way of interacting with each other, which you could think of perhaps akin to norms, like social norms. There's an etiquette to this. I heard someone say when I brought live musicians into a classroom once, I had never heard this before. He was like, yeah, so traditionally, if there's a singer, the piano player takes the first solo. I never knew that. Huh. It could be wrong.
Yeah, could be that person's reality.
It could be that, you know, but I was just like, oh, well, I didn't know that piece of the tradition. Like, we don't have a horn player come blaring and we have the accompanist who is already accompanying the singer on the, you know, typically the main harmonic instrument, take the first solo. I don't know why that is. But there are rules to this and there are norms to this. And so it's those things allow strangers to be able to converse in the language of jazz at a jam session who've never met each other in the same way that if we have a similar understanding of society, current events, history, I can have a, you know, conversation about politics with a stranger. So I don't know if it's more or less than other musics and other types of government, but I think those are some of the things that make jazz a decent representation of American democracy.
Yeah. And I think it's a really interesting point about that freedom within structure, because in understanding, you know, political science, different government frameworks, you're often mapping things out in different forms of government based on the balance between liberty, equality, and order.
Right.
And the prioritization that's put on different ones kind of determines what form of government you have.
Right.
And jazz and democracy both place liberty very, very high.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you get rid of order altogether.
Right.
Because if you do, then you've got anarchy.
Exactly. So I like to say that is the real trick of it, I think, in society, in a democratic society, or at least one that aspires to democratic ideals, and on the jazz bandstand, we're trying to strike the balance between the individual freedom and what's best for the group. I did a residency with, I think there were eighth graders in East Oakland, right after the Sandy Hook shooting.
Oh, wow.
And the residency was about the Second Amendment. Right. And so it was like, and it was contentious for me, because East Oakland is not the safest place in the world. And these kids had real opinions about guns. Yep. Had real life opinions, not theory, but real life opinions about guns. The task of the whole residency was to rewrite the Second Amendment in such a way that you could allow 18th century Americans the right, and what I think we agreed on was the need, to have guns as a bulwark against tyranny, because that's really literal at that time. And yet we agreed, well, we can't have kids die in school, right? So we have individual freedom and what's best for the group, right? The greater good. So could you reword it in such a way, reword the Second Amendment, that is, in such a way that we could somehow have both, that we could give that freedom at the time when that musket was necessary and tantamount to freedom itself, and somehow avoid the current situation that we were living through. And so we had discussions about, like, if you could write local gun laws, what would they include? How would they be structured? Who could have guns? Who should not have guns? Right. And so again, I think jazz musicians are particularly adept at balancing that individual voice, but always, it seems, at least from the people that I've interviewed, always thinking about the composition, the music itself, and where are we, not just where am I and who am I? Right. So it's a difficult balance. It's obviously easier among a trio or even a quintet, even a big man, to sort those things out than a country of 320 plus million. Right. But the fact that they're engaged in it is where I make use of the metaphor.
Yeah. And I'm just doing the math in my head. I'm like, okay, so these kids, if they were in year eight right after Sandy Hook, that means maybe they're like 28, getting close to 30.
Yeah.
Maybe some of them will be in Congress soon. And right. I really hope they can apply these lessons. I think these are the important, you know, that's a really big principle to undertake. But I think applying that unique framework helps you come at it from a different angle. And hopefully we find some creative solutions to what has led to a lot of discord.
Indeed.
In our politics. So now you've got a clip for us.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about this first clip?
Yeah.
Set it up for us and then tell us what principle it kind of illustrates.
Yeah. So you mentioned the ABC interview, and I think that interview opened with this clip, and we didn't give credit for it on air. So I was like, I want to go to this one first because I want to give credit. So this is the 90 Miles Project featuring Stefan Harris, David Sanchez, and Christian Scott in this particular iteration. It also had Nicholas Payton, I think, at one time. But they're performing live in Cuba, and it's a Stefan Harris solo, and he plays vibraphone. So this is somewhat rare. So vibraphone, I mean, there have been great vibraphone players throughout jazz history, but it's going to sound a bit like it's a very sonorous, like, bell sound. Mm. I want you to pay attention to Stefan Harris playing vibraphone and the piano player, Harold Lopez Nusa, responding. So because it's the vibraphone solo, it means Stephon Harris is leading. The rhythm section, aside from the piano player, they're kind of just holding down this groove. There's bass, there's drums, there's a djembe player. And they're just kind of holding down this pulse. Bass player's there. You know, there's a few chord changes, certainly in this small clip that we have. I want you to pay attention to the fact that Stephon Harris is saying something and the piano player doesn't know when he's done speaking. Huh. And he tries to come in the spaces. And he's successful sometimes. And then they kind of get in each other's way a little bit every now and again. So just pay attention again, vibraphone and piano.
Good. Now I feel like I just want to go back and listen to it again. It's 30 seconds. It's so short, but why don't you break it down for us?
Okay. So the things I'm noticing is there was a part where there was kind of like some cascading lines from Stephon Harris. And you'll notice if you go back and listen to it one more time, that's when the piano player laid out. It's like, oh wait, he's busy saying something. I need to give him the space. A little bit earlier in that clip, there was more space and the piano player was filling in. There was one particular emphatic note on vibraphone and the piano player. I can't remember if you play the same note on piano or something that matched harmonically. So the thing that I want to highlight from this clip is the listening. So when I talk to musicians about, you know, what they're up to on the stage, like what's the goal? How are they, what are they thinking about? What are they feeling? The thing that comes up over and over again is listening. So it's fair to say that it's the number one skill that's being employed on the jazz bandstand. I like to say, if you ask 10 jazz musicians, what's the number one skill on the jazz bandstand? 7 of them will probably say listening if they're worth their salt. And the other 3, you simply don't want in your band because the answer is listening. You know, I interviewed Terrence Blanchard once and he talked about somebody subbed on drums once. And they came off the stage saying, wow, I have to be careful what I play in your band. Because no matter what I play, everyone responds. Huh. It's like no one's on autopilot. It's a fascinating thing, by the way. This you may want to cut this out. I know it's kind of an aside. But like when I interviewed musicians, particularly Stephon Harris, the vibraphone player in that clip. And I asked him, like, how do you practice to get ready to play with other people? Because practice is an independent solo endeavor. You in the practice room by yourself. You know, maybe you've got some backing tracks you're going to work with or whatever, but it's a lot of time you alone with your instrument. So how do you get ready for collective improvisation? This thing that makes jazz what it is, right? And he said, so he pretty much sticks to the fundamentals when he's actually at the instrument. But he was like, but I practice when I'm not at the instrument. Okay, what does that mean? So he says, I go to a cafe. He lives in New York. I think maybe it's New Jersey, but a busy place. Go to a cafe, sit outside, sit and I try to listen to the conversation at the table next to me, what the person is ordering at the counter, and how long can I track the bus that just passed me going down the street all at the same time.
Wow.
I interviewed Lakeisha Benjamin, who's an alto player, who said, look, when I do long tones, which is the thing that saxophone players have to do, it's just about making your voice clear. So it's like building your embouchure and your articulation on the instrument. She says, so when I practice long tones, I turn on the TV and I do it for however long, half an hour or whatever. And then I'll sit down and write the plot of the TV show that was on TV while I was doing the long tones. Because she wants that the ear channel open while she's also focused on trying to articulate the sound that she's making, both at the same time. So unlike you and I right now, when I'm speaking, you're quiet. For verbal language, that's what's required, as far as I understand it anyway. So it works best for me. Shut up and listen, right? In jazz, you're listening and talking the whole time, especially if you're in the rhythm section, which is traditionally piano, bass, drum, sometimes guitar, maybe an organ. But these instruments that keep the song form going, they're kind of always playing. So, which means they're always talking in a sense, but they're always also listening to the soloist and trying to respond. So that piano player in that clip, he's comping, which is accompanying. I also think of it as complimenting in this case, especially. He doesn't have to do anything, but he's deciding, he's choosing to try to say something that complements what Stefan Harris is playing on vibes. And to do that, it's like laser focus. We're going to put the link to the video on YouTube in the show notes. Go to this clip and the camera angle is great. It's looking at Stefan, but it's like you can see the piano player right behind him. And he's just locked in. He's laughing. He's into it. Stefan Harris is an incredible soloist. And also, this song is very rambunctious. Oh. So this part was very serene. But the rest of it is kind of, the dynamic range is wide on this tune. So you're going to see a whole wide range of interaction. But the listening is got to be happening all the time. And, you know, obviously to people listening, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we actually listened to people in politics as well? Oh. There's a difference between, you know, waiting to speak and listening. And there's also a difference, I think, between, you know, listening for, I suppose, the vulnerability in your adversary. And I don't mean in the tender way that a jazz musician might then play the perfect chord to capture your voice. I mean, no, because you're going to gut punch him in that spot. You know what I mean? That's an adversarial. Tactical, yeah. Right? I mean, you know, we always want our side to win. And however the game is being played, you want to win it. But jazz also tells us that the process matters, right? That's another key thing, which we'll get to.
So why don't you tell us, how does this, you know, in this context, you know, with the listening and the give and the take, the finding, you know, the greater good and how that factors into everything. How does the current form of democracy that we have right now in the U.S. kind of fit into this jazz metaphor and description?
Well, I should say at the outset that when I'm in front of a classroom and I'm teaching kids, you know, about jazz as a metaphor for democracy, I don't need it to fit neatly all the time. If my goal is really critical thinking and having kids think both critically and creatively, you know, using the arts to get kids to think about current events in U.S. history or whatever, if you can tell me where the metaphor breaks down, that's equal evidence of critical thinking. So, I mean, unfortunately, I think, first of all, I'm almost always giving examples of good jazz. I'm very rarely giving examples of bad jazz. But I think jazz is a good metaphor for a well-functioning democracy. And I think bad jazz is a good metaphor for a malfunctioning democracy. So,
did you bring any clips of bad jazz?
I didn't. And there's this one album. I think I've saved the YouTube video instead of actually buying it because I kind of don't want to support it. it's okay to say though, because it's a good example. There's a comedian. I can't think of his name offhand, but there's a comedian, and there's something like this person's name. He plays jazz for the first time, so he literally hires a professional rhythm section, but he's gonna play piano. So he's got bass, drums, and I think a horn player. He's literally never played. I don't even know if he's played piano before. So they do a whole recording, and like those hired guns are none the wiser, I think, when they actually do the recording.
Oh my gosh.
And they record a whole CD with him just like at the piano, not knowing which end is up, you know? Now, some people think of jazz as cacophonous. Mm. They hear it and they think, what the heck is happening? And so an untrained ear, or maybe someone who dislikes jazz, could listen to that and say, yeah, it sounds jazzy to me. You know? But, you know, you get into the nuances of a thing and you're like, oh, this guy has no idea what he's doing. And so I would argue you don't want that in democracy. You don't want, when I talked earlier about tradition, you don't want someone who doesn't know the tradition. We're actually going to come to this later when we talk about the so-called jazz president unit that I do. But I think the listening thing is key. I remember when I started the Jazz and Democracy Project, it was the first year of the Obama administration. And I, you know, the whole just, what do you call it? Obstructionist Congress was like the thing. That was the thing at that time, right? You know, if you dislike the politics of the president, you know, sure, I want my senator and my congressperson to be obstructionist. Yes, please. Thank you. You know, But I unfortunately, I feel like we're at a worse place today, and you should probably talk to people who are more keen on this than I am. But I feel like the problem now is we don't agree on the structure, or we have such divergent reads of whether it's the Constitution or American history or something that just happened. And, you know, we have all these media silos. People are, you know, the confirmation bias is heavy on all sides, right?
Yep.
And so it's like, we don't even agree on what happened at this event or what it means. Or so maybe it's not that the structure is so different, but it's whatever is our mediation between what we think and the Constitution or the history or this moment, current events or otherwise, that we're not even seeing things the same way. And so, I mean, it's hard to think of an example of that on the bandstand. I mean, it's like, I mean, you have people, I had a musician tell me once, I think it was at the Monterey Jazz Festival, saxophone player, Howard Wiley, great saxophone player back in the Bay Area. He was like, the band started playing and I, you know, they kind of set the song up. He said, and I came in and I was playing the wrong song. Like he just started playing. He was like, it was just a brain. Like he started playing the wrong song. I think he told the story in a class and he was like, and so the band just shifted.
Wow.
They just shifted. Right. And it's like, okay, well he's out there. Like he's hanging out there on a limb by himself, looking like he doesn't know what he's doing. Let's make him not look like that. So we all recognize what song he's playing. Boom. We just go. You know, so there's a lot of complimenting again, if you think it's worth going in that direction, I suppose. But then, you know, we have the politics of, well, I don't want to go in that direction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's a couple interesting things I'm thinking of off the back of that. Like one is, okay, if you're looking at the two parties versus each other, that's okay. More adversarial. That's sure. A different thing.
Sure.
But if you're looking at one thing where it's like, okay, we're all players on the same team. Look at what's happened with the Republican Party.
Yeah.
As they have changed who's the, you know, figurehead of their party, they've had to do some radical shifting and changing. But we are seeing this kind of scrappy tussling and working out, oh, this thing is different. And then they kind of come together behind a leader, or they look at a new example and then they might shift and they might pivot. People will agree or disagree. Right. But a large thing seems to be that sense of, well, we're this party, we're in it together. They're playing a different song.
Right.
We'd better get in line and pivot right. And play that song. That seems to be what's right. Going on.
Because we're in the band regardless.
Yes. Yes.
We're in that band.
Yeah, exactly. But on the concept, when you've got the two parties, you know, versus each other,
yeah.
You know, in your teaching, you talk about this concept of trading in yeah. Jazz. And I instantly thought about, you know, the presidential debates. It's such yeah. A great example of where we have that kind of, you know, not exactly call and response, but it's like you're meant to be hearing two voices coming through on this topic. Can you share with us about how the concept of trading works? And is this what we see at play in the modern presidential debates?
Yeah. Okay. So trading is, if I've already described jazz as a musical conversation, again, where people are conversing and talking and listening the entire time, trading is often a back and forth between two musicians. In the example I have, that's what it is. I've also seen it where it'll be the horn player's turn, then the drummer, then the piano, then the drummer, then the bass, then the drummer, then back to the horn player and the drummer. They pivot off the drummer around the bandstand. But basically what it means is we're trading bars, some number of bars. So often trading fours is common. So I take four bars, you take four bars. Whatever the song form is, the song form keeps going around and around. Thanks to the rhythm section, they keep playing the song form and we're soloing on top of it. But I'm only going to take four bars of the sequence and then you take the next four bars and then it's back to me for four bars and then back to you. Sometimes they trade 8/16. Sometimes there's a 32 bar AABA song form and they'll take a whole chorus and then just trade off choruses. So we've got a clip here. It's so funny when you brought this up, I was like, oh, the one example I always think of is the Latin side of John Coltrane, which was a project by Conrad Herwig, the trombone player. And so I've got a 30-second clip here. I think it's exactly 30 seconds of Brian Lynch on trumpet. And I think when the clip comes in, Brian Lynch is starting and then Conrad Herwig. And I'm the way I'm counting this, I'm thinking of it as four bars in cut time. I'm counting like eight quarter notes, whatever. You can hear there's the same amount of space given to each person and they go back and forth.
Okay. All right. Let's hear this clip.
So when I spoke earlier about, you know, we know what the conversation is going to be, but we don't know what's going to be said, right? So the conversation is the composition Blue Train, the John Coltrane classic, which they've done here in an Afro-Cuban style. And again, those chord changes are good. Blue Train is primarily a blues, so it's like 1-4-5 chords, not exactly maybe the traditional or standard blues form, but those chords are going around and those guys are talking to each other. With that background, they had some horns in the back, some percussion hits. Cause you know, those guys are feeling the fire too. Right. So, I mean, when I think about presidential debates, you know, I mean, the one that keeps coming to my mind, as I think we talked about in preparation for this, was the somewhat infamous Biden Trump debate. And that's 2020, right?
Yeah. 2020.
And so you'll notice in that clip, that they took their four bars and then they were quiet so the other person could take their four bars. And you will remember from that presidential debate, Trump just kept going. He kept stepping on Biden's space, solo time. And for me, that was frustrating. For certain viewers, that was the best part. I'm quite sure.
Yeah.
Like the people who voted for him, like, ah, I love this guy. He's like not letting the other guy get a word in edgewise or whatever. There's a tradition in jazz of the jazz battle. Cutting contests be like one band, a big band on one side of a barn on a stage. And on the other side of the barn, there'd be a different band. And they'd play the same song back to back. And the dancers in the middle decided who won. Right? Like whoever swung it the hardest, they're the ones who won. Right. And then there's this tradition in even within trading of like, I'm trying to one up you. So it is, it's a battle in a sense. It's like, these are egos at battle. And I'm, you know, I'm not trying to get shown up by you. I want to be the supreme tenor saxophone player on this bandstand. So let's go. So that exists. But I remember interviewing Joshua Redman and he said, look, yes, that exists. And whenever I'm engaged in trading, I try to subvert that particular tradition and I try to have a conversation. So the thing that I love when I hear trading, it wasn't so much in that example, I don't think, but it's like someone will play like a descending line and the first note of the next person's four bars would be the last note of the previous person's four bars. So it's like, I'm going to extend this idea. If you go up, I'll go down. If you play loud, I'll play loud. Or maybe you play loud and I'll play soft. But it's clear that we're listening to each other. Whatever I've played lets me know. Or lets you know that I heard you. Right. So even in that example, they weren't so much, you know, extending each other's phrases per se in the way that I just described. But it, when I listen to that, I hear them having the same conversation, and allowing the other person's voice to be heard in that conversation. And that's what's paramount, I would say. The other thing I thought about as I was prepping for this is in a way, you could be thrilled in trading in jazz in the way akin to maybe the free market of ideas. Like if these two really good musicians start trading and they really start having a conversation, then we're going to get a good idea and a better idea and a still better idea and a just something that's going to really, you know, blow the roof off the place. And then yet, even though you think it couldn't go higher, there'd be another idea. So it's like maybe the dialogue, the discourse gets better as it goes forward. Right. And that's what you want. But again, for me, the thing I'm always hearing, listening for, and am thrilled when I hear it is that I can tell that you heard the other person. And in that now infamous debate, it's like, it's the opposite. It's the lack. It's an undemocratic thing, I would say. I think most people would agree to believe that only my voice should be heard and to believe that I should never lose. That's undemocratic. Like that's monarchy in a way. You know what I mean? I mean, I remember watching the, you know, I watched the Ken Burns jazz series, but there was a fascinating comment in the Ken Burns baseball series by George Will, who I believe was, you know, the slate was, you know, conservative thinker or something, writer, columnist. He said he likened baseball to American democracy by saying, first of all, understand that the defense has the ball. Whereas in most sports, the offense has the ball. He says, and a really good batter in baseball bats 300, which means you only get a hit 3 out of 10 times, which is another way of saying you fail the majority of the time. He was like, if that's not a good metaphor for American democracy and political fights, I don't know what is. You're not going to win all the time. Yeah. You don't get to have it your way. We are, as I said before, in process, creating this thing together. You don't always win. For the process sake, it's not important that you always win. It's that the process has integrity. And that's what we heard in that example of trading, in which I think we didn't hear in that presidential debate.
Yeah. And it feels like when we don't have the give and take or space to hear both, you know, the audience, the public are the losers because you can't hear or understand really what either one of them are saying. And it's like, what's the point?
Right. A rambunctious, like a band on fire is not the same as cacophony.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. You can tell when there's this thing in jazz that they tend to strive for is this idea of swing. And there's a balance of voice, of dynamics, of space, of time, soloing, et cetera. And, you know, when a band is just playing like they don't care about each other, like you can hear it and it's a drag.
That's very true. Now, before we get to the by the numbers bit, I'm keen to touch on these, your list of 9 traits of a good jazz musician and how they're also qualities of a good president. Like, and this election in particular, we're not just comparing 2 candidates for president, but we are both comparing candidates who have both already served as president. They have a presidential track record.
Right.
So how would you apply this framework to President Biden and former President Trump?
Great. Okay. So I did this unit with students in 2016. I think I did it in the spring and then I did it in the fall. And then this is the unit that I use when I'm training teachers. This is like my sample unit it's useful every 4 years at least. you could use it for local elections just the same. So I've got these 9 traits of a good jazz musician. I call the quote unquote the jazz standard. So I'll just run through these. When I'm doing the unit, I have quotations from my interviews with jazz musicians to exemplify like what this thing means. And we use this standard as the yardstick for students to measure the candidates, typically based on particular issues and the candidate's position on those issues. Anyway, I'll run through this. This would be a bit listy. So if you want, just jump in or I can throw it to you and let me know what you think or whatever. Yep. So number one, improvisation, right? As we talked about, this is a key feature of jazz. So does this candidate have the skills and the resources to deal with the unexpected? Okay. So you would take that information and you would think, okay, so some of that is about experience, whatever, which is look, number 2 on the list, experience. So do they have the right background, education, other experience to do the job? Number 3, tradition. Do they know enough about being president? And this is also leaning toward what you often hear during election cycles of, is this person presidential? Right?
Is that linked with like the norms as well that you discussed earlier?
I would argue.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, do you know what this, like, do you revere it? Like you can feel how you want about any, you know, swing of the pendulum in politics, but like, shouldn't you revere the office if you're running for the office? Right. Have you cared enough about it to know something about it? Right. Yeah. Number 4, vision. which is related to policy. So do you agree with their vision of and for America? So that's obviously very personal. Like, is this person saying that they're going to do the things that you want? Fine. Five, listening. Now, the thing about this one, I said it was number one on the jazz bandstand. The way that I approach this is, who will they listen to? Right? Because they're going to listen to the people who voted for them. They're going to listen to which advisors, who are going to be their advisors. What are they open to? Which is number six. Open. Are they open to new information and ideas? And then parenthetically, I always have to add, do you want them to be? Like, on certain issues, no, this person 100% represents my belief and understanding. I don't want to entertain anything else. That's why I voted for, right? And that's fair too. Number seven, negotiation. Will they negotiate well? And again, do you want them to? On certain things, do you want there to be compromise, or do you want a hard line? We all have our hard line areas.
Yep.
And then, but I think in general, I would like to think we want the president, again, to be open and to be able to negotiate and compromise on certain issues. Number eight, this idea of the greater good, right? So do they think about doing the best for the most people, or are they selfish, or are they too myopic? Anyway, we could talk all day about that. Number nine, honesty. I remember it was actually, to bring it around full circle, it was Stefan Harris who brought this up in our interview. The vibraphone is from the first clip. It was like, man, you got to be honest to play this music. Like, you can bring whatever you want to bring as long as you bring it honestly. So do you think this candidate is sincere or fake? And then again, these parenthetical follow-ups, do you like who they really are? Or are you okay with the persona that they're putting on? You know, politics is not jazz. You know, and campaigning is not the same as being president, right? So again, I have students use this list as a way to think about, okay, this candidate on this issue, am I in agreement with them? Would I vote for them? You know, I did do a whole classroom thing where they kind of caucus and argue and the class votes, and it's a whole microcosm type thing. But you know, I mean, I've run those nine things through with some adults. I think it was in 2020 on Zoom when we were all, you know, trapped at home. And it felt like we covered all the things one way or another. Cause that list isn't about the policies or what they said, but you can bring in anything, any information you want to that yardstick. And yeah, it's a good way to think about who do we want to lead in the country?
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting framework, and it's not so much about a binary, like who's the winner or who's the loser. It's more about working out in your own head. Right. Where do you land? Who do you support, and what really are the values that would drive your decision, which right. I think is very important, especially in a year when so much of it can be based on knee-jerk reactions.
Right.
Or like one specific thing, but to take a more comprehensive, holistic view and
right.
determine how you're going to vote accordingly. Exactly. All right. Well, I've absolutely loved diving into this metaphor of jazz and democracy with you. And just before we end, could you share with us the by the numbers stat you've got for us?
I will. Now, this is a little bit of a shameless plug.
That's fine.
So I hope I can do that. Okay. But my number is two.
Okay.
And it's a little bit deuces wild. So when this podcast airs, I will be almost exactly 2 years in Australia.
Uh-huh.
And, oh, sorry. Yeah, I will be, no, actually, when it airs, I will be 2 months from the 2 year anniversary of my being in Australia.
Okay.
But I have only presented the Jazz and Democracy Project at two schools. Actually, it was one school twice.
They really love you.
Right.
Can't get enough.
And I'm grateful for it. It's Rosebank College and Five Dock. Thank you for having me back, let alone the first time. So that's my shameless plug. It's like, look, if anything I've said in this podcast sounds like, oh, that'd be an interesting way to get my kid, or I know this school, or I'm myself a teacher or a principal. But it sounds like a cool way to get kids to value and appreciate these democratic ideals that we hold dear, even here in Australia. I'm not just teaching U.S. history per se. These things travel. then please give me a call. We will, we will have the website in the show notes. I do this. I haven't done it nearly enough in this country, and I am rip roaring ready to go.
Okay. So we will put the link to his website in the show notes so you can check it out. And just from my perspective, obviously I love, you know, government, politics, all of this analysis. But one of the things that I find particularly compelling about what West delivers is this critical thinking framework that I feel is really unique and different. You could apply it to a lot of different things, but I think the fact that you take the kids through this exercise in critical thinking is just fantastic and really a great exercise. Whether your kid loves, you know, politics and government and civics or not, I think that's a worthwhile exercise. And
don't worry about knowing jazz. So, you know what? The thing I never said was, I'm not a jazz musician.
Save that till the end.
Right. Well, I usually try to say it up front. But like, you know, I'm not myself a jazz musician. Like, I'm just a lover of the music. Yeah, I've interviewed a bunch of jazz musicians now, thankfully, and that forms the basis of the program. You know, the audio and the transcription of those interviews to help kids get inside the process and use those interview excerpts to, you know, analyze things about history and current events or ethics, morals. I've been at a school and their motto was like responsibility and integrity and blah, blah, blah. Great. Let's talk about that. Things like leadership, teamwork, you know, all these things can be had or addressed, I should say, using this material that I've gathered. And like you said, it's critical. Hopefully it's creative. I get kids talking and analyzing things about a performance video, and they're not even aware that they're exercising critical thinking skills, but they are. And then before you know it, I've taken out some current events or the Constitution and we're in.
Yep.
So it's good stuff, I think.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Wes. And just as we wrap up, I'd like to point out a couple of other podcasts that may be of interest. Our CEO, Dr. Michael Green, is the co-host of the Asia Chessboard podcast with Jude Blanchett, the Freeman Chair for China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And I'd also recommend checking out the USSC Live podcast series that runs recordings from our major live events in 2024, including our Election Watch kickoff. You can find these on our website at ussc.edu.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again so much, Wes. And I encourage everyone to check out his website in the show notes.
Many thanks.